Hi, Barry. Good to have you on the show.
Hey, Hardy. Thanks for having me.
For everyone who doesn't know you, could you please tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. I do a few things. I am the Chairman and Chief Investment Officer of Ritholtz Wealth Management, which runs about $1.2 billion in client assets. I have been writing and commenting about markets and investing for the better part of the past 20 years. I used to write for the Washington Post. Now I have a column with Bloomberg. I'm the author of Bailout Nation, a book about the financial crisis. And these days, I'm probably best known for my podcast, Masters in Business, which is a show on Bloomberg Radio.
So, could you please share with us the story behind, like, how did you get into wealth management and all those different things that you are currently involved in?
I have like a very, I get a question from students who are interested in pursuing a career in finance, looking for advice, career advice, and how to follow a path. And I'm really the worst person to ask that question because my career is just a series of happenstances and lucky events and a handful of really odd twists that led me to where I am today. But
What happened?
well, undergraduate, I was applied mathematics and physics, but of which I was pretty good at, not great, but pretty good. At the time, the chairman of the math department at my school was an unknown geek named Jim Simons, who later went on to form and found Renaissance Technologies. But I quickly figured out, hey, I'm pretty good, but a lot of these people are fantastic, and I don't want to compete against them in the job market. They're just amazing. So I switched to political science and philosophy, and after college, didn't know what to do with myself, so I went to law school, which is surprisingly similar to math and physics. It's a very structured, rule-driven set of approaches, syllogistic approaches to problem solving and applying rules to fact patterns and trying to come out with a conclusion. And I loved law school, but found that I hated the practice of law. It was really tedious and detail-oriented and everything I was not. And when the opportunity came along in the early to mid 90s to join a friend's trading shop, I jumped at it and started as a trader.
Okay. And how old were you back then?
Early 30s, something like that.
Okay.
So yeah, this has got to be 25 years ago. So early 30s. I was fascinated by trading, and not I was actually pretty good at it. Not, again, not great, but pretty good. But I was more intrigued by we would sit on these long trading desks. There'd be 20, 30 guys on a desk,
And
and I was
sorry to
always
interrupt, but how were you
sure.
able to do this? Because you had no background in trading, so.
Nobody has a background in trading. They take you to the deep end of the pool. They throw you in, and whoever swims is a trader, and whoever drowns, fails out of the program. It's not like 50 years ago where there was this entire process of training people to be retail brokers. Trading has always been you kind of mentor with somebody, they bring you along, you either learn or you don't. It's pretty much that approach. So I was less intrigued by the actual trading and more fascinated by how come this guy on my left is making all this money this month, and the guy on my right is losing money, and then next month it switched. And so I started doing more and more research. The best part about having a background in law is one of the things you learn is there is no subject that is impervious to more research, more learning, more experience, more knowledge. And so the legal process teaches you, hey, you may not be an expert in anything, but you should be able to teach yourself to be reasonably competent and be able to understand all sides of an issue. That's what makes law school such a fascinating experience. They don't teach you what to think. They teach you how to think. And that background and training is probably why there's a decent number of ex-attorneys as fund managers, analysts, researchers in finance. It's a very transferable set of schools, set of skills.
And what happened then?
So after about 5 years of making money and giving some of it back and making money, I decided the right career thing to do was to move into the research side. I had been researching and writing about markets for my own edification, just so I felt like I had a better handle on what was going on each day. And what started as really my own set of notes that I would just type up each morning for myself, first they started getting Xeroxed and shared around the office, and then they started getting faxed to other offices, and then eventually it became an email list. And that in the late 90s became a blog on Yahoo GeoCities. And then in 2003, I was a beta tester for Six Apart. They were the company behind the TypePad software. And that's where I launched my blog, The Big Picture, which in 2008 moved over to WordPress. And I've been writing there ever since.
And how did this change your life, like starting a blog and all those different things? So, yeah.
The blog definitely was a key pivot point in my professional career. I kind of started writing for a couple of reasons. First, it's very helpful to figure out what you think if you write it down. Daniel Boorstin, the former Librarian of Congress, once wrote, "I write to figure out what I think, and besides, at that hour, all the bars are closed." But it's really true. You know, our thought process is very amorphous and squishy and ill-defined. And once you stake out a position and put it down on paper and explain it, marshal the evidence, and lay out your arguments, that's really a big accomplishment. And it's far more precise than our own internal thought process, which is very fraught with error and squishy and ill-defined. So being really specific and articulate about a particular view, whether it was where the market was, what the economy looked like, just general perspectives on what was going on, putting it down on paper really makes a big difference to your own thinking.
Yeah, and I can relate to that because I'm also journaling a lot, and I think it just makes you sharper. If you're writing down ideas and you're exploring them through your writing and so on and so forth. So, Barry.
So on the strength of the blog, I eventually get invited to write for thestreet.com. That eventually leads to the Washington Post, which leads to Bloomberg. And here we are today.
And could you please also speak about starting your own company? And how did that happen, and so on and so forth, and
So I've spent most of my career turning down money. I always thought that if you managed assets, well, it might bias your perspective. It might change the way you look at the world. And in hindsight, that was probably a mistake. Although sometimes you have to take a specific path to get to where you're going, and it may not be a straight line. About a decade ago, 2010, I went to a conference in San Diego, and San Diego was supposed to be the nicest weather in the country. Meanwhile, I'm at this conference, and it's cloudy and overcast and hazy, and I don't care. I'm going to go sit down by the pool because New York in the winter is cold and dark and miserable. And I'm in sunny San Diego. I'm going to the pool. And at the pool, I met a young guy named Josh Brown, who was a stockbroker. And we hit it off. We started, talking and laughing and joking and just generally having a good time. And he said, I asked him, what are you doing on the sell side, meaning the brokerage side? You're too smart for that. And he got, his answer was, I don't know. I haven't figured out how to get to the buy side. And so we talked about him joining the firm I was at the time, which he did a few months later. And he was with us for, less than 6 months when he said to me, how do you keep turning down people offering you money? Now keep in mind, this was 2010. I had a pretty good call about the market in 07 and 08. In January 08, we were 100% cash. And then I went on TV in March 09 on Yahoo Finance and said, you could buy stocks here. The worst is over. Cover your shorts and you could go long here. It happened to be the very day the market bottomed and reversed. So I credit that to dumb luck more than anything. You could have asked me the same question a month earlier, a month later, I would have given you the same answer. So catching the top and catching the bottom is certainly not the way I would recommend people manage their assets. But that sort of thing generates a lot of fame and attention, and people are throwing money at you. Also, the book came out in late 09, Bailout Nation, about the financial crisis. Very well reviewed. That also generated a lot of buzz. And Josh had said to me, dude, you can't say no to millions and millions of dollars. You tell me why you don't want to do this. And I said, two reasons. I don't want to do the administrative back office stuff, which is a big pain in the neck. And second, I don't want clients who are so full of emotion, be it fear at the bottom or greed at the top, I don't want them to interfere with my process of objectively looking at the markets, the economy, the world. And he said, well, I'll run interference for you with the clients and I'll handle all the back office stuff. Let's form a partnership. We did, and we very quickly raised about $100 million. And
$100 million.
It didn't make any sense to stay at a firm that was philosophically the opposite of what I was preaching about asset management. Hey, you're not very good at picking stocks. You're not very good at timing the market. Your emotions are in the way. Here's an idea. Just have a low-cost diversified portfolio of global stock indexes, rebalance it once or twice a year, and put it away for four decades. Don't think about it. That was the message we were telling people, which is kind of funny because I'm the guy who was making market calls about, hey, it's the top of the market, get out. Hey, it's the bottom of the market, get in. That is absolutely not how we manage money, because I can't tell you if I'm a genius or I'm just goddamn luck, and neither can anybody else. That's the fascinating thing.
Are you serious or just being humble?
No, this is not a false humility. We have $1.3 billion. I don't want to take that money and move in and out on the possibility that I'm going to get it right again. This is people's lives and their savings and their retirements. And what are the odds that anybody is going to get this right twice? To me, it's really a low set of, by the way, what a lot of my research and a lot of the academic literature makes pretty clear, market corrections and crashes come along on a regular basis. And rather than try and time it and get it wrong, where the costs for getting it wrong are pretty catastrophic, I can't tell you the number of emails I got post-crisis. Hey, I followed you out of the market in 08, but when you got back in 09, I thought you were crazy, and I've been sitting in cash ever since, says the email in 2010, 2011, 2012. We were getting them up to 2014, same emails. And, if you miss a market that doubles or triples, you will never, your portfolio will never recover from that over the course of your lifetime. So the danger for getting it wrong is so catastrophic. Listen, it's one thing to mess around with $100,000. It's something else to say, this is $1.3 billion or 1.2. So I don't even know where the market closed yesterday. That'll tell us where assets are. Instead, you can construct a portfolio that is robust enough to survive the ups and downs. I like to say the optimal portfolio isn't the one that's going to generate the highest returns. It's the one that you're going to live with. Think about how many people panicked in January, February, March, sold out, and then missed the recovery. So the greatest portfolio in the world that you can't stay with is worthless. But a portfolio that's going to give you, let's call it 70% equity, 30% bonds, or 60-40, you'll get much of the upside, but not all of it. And you'll get some of the downside, but you'll avoid most of it or much of it. And if you can live with that for 20, 30 years, you'll do just fine. And that's how we manage assets. We do a combination of financial planning and behavioral counseling that is designed to help meet client needs. But that philosophy and explaining that, which is much more common today, 10 years ago, that was kind of, you know, the exception, not the rule. We're seeing more and more people adopt that, hey, just take what the market gives you, as opposed to trying to beat the market, where statistically the odds are that not only won't you beat the market, you won't even get what the market gets. You're going to underperform. And that philosophy, understanding the math behind that, understanding why most people underperform the market, really has colored how I see the world.
So before we get deeper into investing and all those different things, could you also please share it out with our audience? Like, what have been for you personally the worst moments so far, and what have been the best moments so far of your life?
You mean personally or professionally?
Both.
Well, my office was located on my headquarters was located on the 29th floor or 39th floor of Two World Trade during September 11th. I was in the satellite office in Long Island. That was kind of a day that stays with you for a long time. I after the first plane hit the first tower, I got a hold of my head trader who was literally on the way to the office when the second plane hit. And he gave me a running dialogue of everything that was going on. And I never take notes. I had the presence of mind to jot down a whole bunch of notes about that. That day was just so surreal. And it was just really one of those days that really just changes how people see the world. That was kind of unusual. I would say that was one of the worst days of anybody's life. I was working for a firm after that called Maxim Group. I love these guys. About $7.5 billion, really, really great group of guys. I was my mentor there was Ed Rose, was the vice chairman and general counsel, and you know, I was sort of an odd duck. I was their market strategist. They were an eat what you kill sort of firm where everybody who generated business got bigger paychecks, bigger bonuses. And they gave me a list of things to do, which I went through, generated all sorts of new connections for them and media coverage and this and that. At Wall Street, everybody gets big bonuses. It's a big part of your comp. And I got my bonus and I was aghast at it. I thought it was missing a zero. And I, after the holidays, so that you get the bonus right before Christmas, most of us were off that week. And then you go in after New Year's and I went into Ed's office and said, is the firm in trouble? I can't take this check from you. If the firm is, you know, going to go out of business, it wouldn't be right. He's like, what are you talking about? I go, this check is missing a zero on it. And otherwise, it's insulting, and I quit. So are you guys going out of business, or do I have to leave? And, you know, he was really apologetic. It's a committee decision, and it was one of those things that I was simultaneously aghast, but it was very freeing to say, look, if you guys don't value the contributions I'm making, then I can't stay here. And I know this is why I tell people don't do what I do career-wise. So with no other job lined up, nothing going on, I basically quit and had to figure out what the heck I was going to do. Eventually, I ended up at the shop where I brought Josh in to work with me, and that led to us launching our own firm in 2013, September of 2013, we launched the firm. So it was one of those really weird things that at the time felt terrible, but turned out to be really fortuitous. If they actually paid me another $100,000 or so, none of this would have happened. The Bloomberg column wouldn't happen. The podcast column podcast wouldn't happen. And I think the launch of our own firm wouldn't happen. It's that sort of thing that seems like a disaster at the time, but turns out to be really fortuitous. You sometimes cannot tell what the results of certain decisions or events are going to be, even at the time as they feel just awful.
And I think most people probably wouldn't walk away from the firm in your situation back then. So
I was so insulted. I was so mortified. you start the year with, here's what we want from you, and these are our expectations. And literally, this isn't a brag. When someone gives you, hey, in order to hit your targets and get your bonus and do this, we want these 10 things. And everything they asked, I did 3, 4, 5x. They wanted to, whatever was on my list, I just shot the lights out. And at that moment, you realize, well, do I just stay here as a salary man? Do I just stay here as someone who's, a junior who is never going to get the recognition or compensation that you think you're worth? And that's a, that's a really challenging moment for anyone. It's not ego for sure is part of it, but it's also, do I just take this much lower path of modest compensation and no upside? All I want is optionality. All I want is the opportunity to succeed. And at that moment, the conclusion I reached was, hey, no matter what I do, I'm never going to succeed here. I could muddle by, but that's not what I want for my career. And so it was a bit of a risk hitting the eject button and saying, I can't stay here if this is what you guys think I'm worth. I don't even have another job. It was one of the few times I ever quit where they said, anytime you want to come back, you're welcome to come back, which is just shocking to me. That's never happened before.
And what were the best moments?
So that last one ended up being one of the best moments, even though it was not purposeful. It just ended up happening. I have to say the launch of the firm on September 15th, 2013 was a pretty fascinating and wonderful moment. It was myself and Josh, and at the time we had two people who were working for us who eventually became our co-founding partners, Michael Batnick, who's now our head of research at Ritholtz Wealth Management, and Chris Venn, who's the director of wealth planning at the firm. And we would have these meetings in our conference room, and they were all really, really nervous about the launch. And I'll never forget, Mike Batnick said to me, how are you not nervous about this? Aren't you stressing? Aren't you freaking out? And my response was, if you ever go on a roller coaster and they put the safety bar down, you could tap out at just about any moment. Once you pull away from the loading area and you go up that first hill and you hear that click, 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 click as the roller coaster climbs that giant, I go, that's where we are now. There's no turning back. There's nothing you could do other than finishing the planning process. And I think that's an important realization to recognize, hey, what can I control? And what is completely up to the fates that are out of my control? So what's within your control, you want to do the best you can to make sure the things, the levers that you can pull, the work that you can do is the best possible product quality it could be. But the things that are out of your control, you have to recognize this is not within my control and deal with it. I'm always shocked at people in my industry who stress out and freak out over markets going up and down. And I remember early in my career as a trader, that sensation of wanting to pull the waste paper basket out from under my desk and just throw up into it because the position I'm in is going against me. And you're just watching tens of thousands of dollars disappear, at times maybe even hundreds of thousands of dollars, that feeling of needing to throw up, of being sick, that's because you are under the illusion that you can control things that are outside of your control. And once you can segment that, once you can compartmentalize, hey, this is what's within your control, focus on this. Hey, you can't control what the Fed's going to do. You can't control where the economy is going to go. You can't control whether the market goes up and down. Once that is understandable, philosophically, your whole world changes. And so understanding that was a big, big recognition. That was pretty early in my trading career. And not too long before I made the decision, maybe I should go into research and not, you know, have to live with the ups and downs of the market. And it turned out to be a good decision.
And I think this doesn't only apply to the investing industry, but to all sorts of different situations in life where people are worrying about things outside of their control, like, oh, is my partner leaving me, or is this happening to my company, or this and that. So yeah, I think it's really important to understand what you just said. So
there's a wonderful Venn diagram. So there's one circle, things that matter, and then the other circle is things that you can control, and then there's a tiny little overlap between the two. Focus on what matters and you can and what you can control. Everything else, hey, it's helpful to be aware of it, but it's pretty meaningless. There's nothing you could do about it. Why stress over things that you can't control or things that don't matter?
So because a lot of entrepreneurs are listening to the podcast and they want to waste money for their companies or for their startups, and what would you tell them on, fundraising? And how were you able to raise so much money in a short time period?
So a couple of things. First, and I've said this to entrepreneurs, they hate it, but I'm going to repeat it. We bootstrapped our entire launch of our firm. We have no outside owners. It's just the founders and the employees. Nobody else is an owner of RWM. And that has allowed us an incredible amount of freedom to do what we want, to set our own strategy, to set our own course. So if there's any way an entrepreneur can bootstrap something and not take outside money, I cannot begin to say how important that is. Now, if you're building a giant software product and you need 27 coders, obviously you're not going to be able to bootstrap that 99% of the time. You're going to need outside money. But be very wary of taking outside money, of giving up control, of giving up more than a slice of the company. It's just too easy to see your dream shattered when someone else gains control. So that's never happened to me, but I've watched it elsewhere, and it's very frustrating. So that's number one. Number two, our model predated the company by 10 years. I started writing in public and sharing what I thought was valuable content. I was fortunate enough to have been warning about real estate in the mid-2000s and warning about subprime and derivatives. And so when the market blew up in first real estate 05, 06, and then the stock market 08, 09, I had been writing and discussing that in public for a long time and challenging much of the mainstream media and what they were writing about. I'll never forget, I want to say it was like 06. So housing in the US is very seasonal, meaning it starts to pick up in February, March. It runs pretty strong through the summer because people, if they're moving, they want to get their kids into the new school district before the school year starts in September. So it peaks around July, August, and then it tails off for the rest of the year. And you can see this in the data. It's very, very clear. The Wall Street Journal, I don't remember if it was 06 or 07, they write a column about, oh, look, housing is getting better. Look, we've had more sales in May than we had in April. Things must be looking up, and all these people bearish on housing are wrong. And I write to the editor and explain, here's what seasonality looks like, and here's what this looks like every year. You can look at it going back 20 years, every year for the past two decades, June is better than May. May is better than April. April is better than March. You have completely misreported this. You're totally wrong. Oh, and by the way, if instead of looking at it from month to month, you look at it from year to year, look at 03 was stronger than 02, 04, 05, 06 is where it peaked. And now 07, May 07 is worse than, or maybe it was May 06 is worse than May 05, and May 07 is worse than May 06. You were wrong. Correct this. And they refused to correct it. So I wrote up a whole blog post about that sort of thing. And I had a lot of math professors and statisticians and real estate people write me and say, I don't know what the hell the Wall Street Journal is reporting, but you're right. So I started to get a following for someone who was not only understood the math of the economy and understood how things work, but I was out on the outside. You know, it's not like I needed to have a good relationship with the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. So I was a bit of a bomb thrower, and I would frequently call people out for being wrong. And P.S., fast forward 15 years, that's one of the hardest transitions to go through, is after you're the guy throwing the Molotov cocktails at the castle, suddenly you're on the inside. It's like, I guess I have to stop making so many enemies now that we have them. But I still will write about things that people get wrong. Only I'm trying to aim higher than just a little mistake in a real estate column. But it's astonishing how most of the mainstream media used to look at economic reporting as something that was, you know, just throw the new guy in, throw someone who's green. And of course they made mistakes. They had no experience and often no math background or economics background. And so I found writing about that and correcting the mainstream media was a good usage of my energies. Same with non-farm payrolls, the employment situation. They get it wrong all the time. New home sales, they got wrong all the time. The data was just so variable and so unreliable that you had to look at a three-month moving average. You couldn't just take any one month because it would often be wildly wrong, and then the next month it would get corrected. And today, I think the media is much better at reporting on economic news because it was not just me, it was lots of other people, but they were eventually embarrassed. And that experience with pushing back against print media is what eventually led me to the podcast. I remember this very vividly. I was coming back from a conference in Vancouver. And when you fly from Vancouver to New York, often you have to change planes in either Chicago or Montreal, go through customs. And I remember there was like a 2 or 3 hour layover, and I'm sitting in the lounge waiting for our plane to be called. And there was some famous hedge fund manager on CNBC, and the interviewer was just asking the worst questions you can imagine. What's your favorite stock? When's the Fed going to cut rates? Where's the Dow going to be next year? It was just one stupid question after another. The moment this guy left the building, all of his answers were stale. And I remember seeing this and just being infuriated by it. And I got on when my plane is called, I open up the laptop and I'm just way furiously, right? And the process of doing that, I come home, my wife asks about the trip, and I tell her this story, and she's like, so what are you going to do about it? What do you mean? Well, you are now part of the media. Why not come up with a response? I'm like, oh, it's not a bad idea. So I'm thinking about this. And when Bloomberg started recruiting me for, originally Tim O'Brien was the editor of the Sunday New York Times business section. He was recruiting me to write for them. And then he joined Bloomberg and launched their Bloomberg Opinion section. And so he continued to recruit me at Bloomberg. When I was in discussions with them about joining, they said, are you interested in a television show? Would you like a regular TV show? And my answer was, no, financial television is awful. Well, what do you want? I want to sit down and have an intelligent conversation with accomplished people, and I don't care about their favorite stocks. I don't care about their market predictions. I want to know who they are and how they got that way. What's their process? What affected them? How did they become the person they are? And July was 5 years of doing that. By the way, when I pitched them on this, Bloomberg didn't really have any podcasts. They said, what do you mean, like 10 minutes instead of a regular 5 minute interview? I'm like, no, like 2 hours. And they laughed and laughed. And they said, no one's going to sit with you for 2 hours. No one's going to listen to it for 2 hours. But tell you what, an hour of radio plus traffic, news, sports, weather, advertising needs 32 minutes of content. You give us 32 minutes. You could do whatever you want for the rest of the time. We'll post it on Apple iTunes. It's fine. Just get us 32 minutes. So that was the deal. When we launched Masters in Business, it was basically me working my way through my friends in my Rolodex. It was people like David Kotok and Chris Whalen. And I can give you a whole list of people who Jonathan Miller and pretty well-known people in the world of finance. That basically were doing me a favor. And eventually it finds an audience. And then I start getting people like Bill Gross and Cliff Asness and Ray Dalio and Howard Marks and Arthur Levitt of the SEC and, you know, Sheila Bair, the head of the FDIC. And it's one after another. And all of a sudden it just catches fire. You know, the Hemingway joke about how someone went bankrupt. It was slowly at first and then all at once. Well, this was slowly at first. It took a couple of years of me sort of feeling like I was talking to myself. And then all of a sudden it just blew up. And the next thing you know, we're getting 5 to 10 million downloads a year. And it's suddenly a hot property. But, you know, it certainly helps to be located in New York City. Everybody eventually passes through New York, and I usually tag them when they do. And I did a good job at leveraging the Bloomberg platform. That their headquarters in New York is a spectacular building. It's purpose-built for technology, information, and media. And so having a professional staff to record it, edit it, it really is something that is wonderful, having a producer to do all the booking. So once the opportunity presented itself, I made the most of it. And I say this all the time, but it's really true. It's the most fun I have all week. To sit down with a Danny Kahneman or a Richard Thaler and spend 90 minutes talking about their work and their career, it's an insane amount of fun. And I really try and take full advantage of the experience.
Yeah, and I can relate to this so much because at the start of like launching my own podcast, it was like really hard to get new guests on the show. But after you recorded like 10 episodes, 20 episodes, 50 episodes, 100 episodes, nowadays like I'm declining most most podcast guests. So
isn't that amazing how that shifts? You go from begging to So my attitude is people have been so generous with their time with me that I feel obligated that, you know, unless it's a really squirrely source, any reasonable podcast that asks me to be the guest, I feel like I can't say no because, the generosity I've had from just, Bob Shiller, someone made a list for me. I think I've had 9 Nobel laureates and 22 billionaires, which is if a billionaire is going to
quite a number, I would say.
It's crazy. It's just crazy. And so the other thing that I do before I have a guest come on the podcast is I have my research assistant and I spend hours and hours and hours researching the person. We read everything they've ever written, all their books, half their articles, and you know, I know more about them than they do. When I'm friendly because he lives in the next town with the Mooch, with Scaramucci, before he was part of the Trump administration. And we did each other's podcasts right before the election, which was pretty hilarious. And I remember having a conversation with him on the podcast about, so you're the guy who saved Dell when you were working at Goldman Sachs. And he looks at me, he's like, that's not public information. And I'm like, well, we did our homework and we found out Dell was, if you go back to the early 90s, the CFO of Dell was trading currencies, trying to hedge, and literally lost a couple of billion dollars. It looked like Dell was going down the tubes. It was such a small deal. Nobody on the Goldman Sachs iBank team wanted to deal with it. To Anthony Scaramucci's credit, he looked at this and said, hey, maybe it's worth saving Dell. Let me see what I could do. And raised them, I don't know, I think it was $100 million back then. And he's like, I don't know how on earth you found that out. It's true, he told the whole story. I didn't have the heart to tell him that about 10 years ago, he and I were out drinking, and he got completely blotto drunk and told me the story. But that's how I found out that Scaramucci saved Dell when he was at Goldman Sachs, and we talked about it on the podcast. So it's any little bit of information you can uncover is incredibly useful down the road.
So could you please tell us two questions that I have on my mind. What is preventing most people to have success long-term on creating wealth? And the second thing is, what would you tell someone in their 20s or 30s on how they, quote-unquote, should think about investing and building wealth long-term?
So let me take the second question first. Mm-hmm. If you're in your 20s and 30s, first, I would recommend Scott Galloway's The Algebra of Happiness. That book is really, really interesting and helpful. And what he's written from his 20 years of experience teaching college students. But second, your 20s and 30s are the period of time when you want to accumulate skills and accumulate knowledge blocks and knowledge sets, meaning everything you should do should be part of a plan of autodidactism, meaning your college is essentially a reading list and a handful of better or worse professors. There's no reason that after college that ends. You need to say, I want to develop a new set of skills and find ways to apply them that will be useful to me personally and to my employer professionally. And just keep on building up your toolkit of skills. I taught myself HTML in the late 90s before there were things like WordPress or Typepad, because if you wanted to post something online, the only way you could do that was coding it in hypertext markup language. There was no other way to do it. And that process, that approach of learning new areas, learning new techniques, becoming more valuable to whoever employs you is an enormous philosophical change that I don't think everybody grasps, that there is no magic formula. You just have to get better and better and better and make yourself indispensable. So your 20s and 30s and even some of your 40s is when you are, you know, busting your ass and not having a lot of fun and working hard. To me, that's the one thing I could point to that I did right in my 30s and 40s, for that matter, was I continued to learn many new things. I continued to develop new skills, and that became useful down the road. Tell me the first question again.
The first question was, what is preventing most people on creating long-term wealth or to create long-term wealth?
I'm going to say I don't know. I mean, I don't want to give you a corny answer like ignorance or fear. I don't know. I think every person is different. Some people clearly spend more money than they earn. That's going to be a problem. Understanding debt, understanding. So the one thing I really figured out later in life was the power of compounding. I think if you're in your 20s and 30s and you understand that money compounded over 30, 40 years is an incredible wealth generator, that would be helpful. But listen, when you're in your 20s and you're making 40 grand and your costs are, you know, you spend every penny you make just to pay the rent. And even if you're not going out and wasting your money, it's very hard to build wealth in that mm-hmm. situation. But the beauty of the capitalist system, flawed as it is if you could develop some ownership in something, that's going to yield significant dividends down the road. And that could be your own business. It could be your own skill set. It could be ownership in other companies. Anything you could do to accumulate assets that will grow, that's going to generate wealth far better than just trading your time for money. Unless you're really lucky, there's a handful of people who could trade their time for money and earn boatloads of cash, but that's 3-5% of the population. Mm-hmm. Most of the population doesn't generate wealth by trading their hours for dollars. They generate wealth by accumulating property. And by the way, generating wealth shouldn't be a goal in and of itself. You know, you want to have enough money to cover your basic security needs, your healthcare, your food, your housing, whatever, your retirement, depending on where you live. I know in the U.S., it's the Wild West. We kind of have to do that for ourselves. In parts of Europe, the state provides a lot of that, so it's a different structure. But the path to wealth, from my perspective, is owning equity, whether it's public stocks or private companies. I think that's how you build wealth over time.
Hmm. So, Barry, at the end, I always ask 5 questions to every guest of the podcast. But before I ask those 5 questions, like, what would be your best advice on all those different things that we've talked about today? Investing, building long-term wealth, quote-unquote success. Like, what would you tell our listeners at this point in our conversation?
Sure. Simplicity is better than complexity. That's number one. Cheap is better than expensive. And, you know, Wall Street tries to make investing look very mysterious. It's not. It's a math problem, and that problem has been solved. And the solution is own a broadly diversified portfolio of low-cost indexes, preferably through tax-advantaged ETFs if you're U.S.-based. If you're overseas-based, you're probably looking at mutual funds. Rebalance that once a year and then leave it alone. You know, the studies have all shown that the more engaged and active investors are, the worse their long-term results are. So buy the world, take a stake in the entire world, US, Asia, Europe, a little bit of real estate, a little bit of commodities, a little bit of bonds, and put it away for 40 years. And when you retire, you'll have a nice nest egg to retire on.
So where can people connect with you, work with you, and so on and so forth?
Sure. My website is ritholtz.com, R-I-T-H-O-L-T-Z. The firm is Ritholtz Wealth. You can follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. Google me. You'll see all of the columns I write on Bloomberg. And you could find Masters in Business also through Google. All of that stuff ends up on the blog at ritholtz.com. The blog is called The Big Picture. Anyone who wants to find me, I'm pretty easy to find. And most days I'm in New York. Our office is right on Bryant Park, dead center of the city. We're pretty accessible.
So the first out of the 5 question is, what are the 3 books that had the greatest influence on your life?
That is such a difficult question. And any 3 books I'm going to give you probably won't get it done. But I'll give you, you know, because I think about all the books I read as a kid, all of my favorite science fiction novels, and Larry Niven and Philip K. Dick and Robert Heinlein and C.J. Sharon, go down the list, which I think were really influential and made me think about technology and the future. But the three most recent books, I'm going to say first, The Information, A History, A Theory, A Flood by James Gleick was a very powerful book that about information theory that explains how we look at knowledge, information, data, how we process it, how it affects us. I think that's something that anybody who deals with data or uncertainty or the unknown should read. It's absolutely fascinating. Mm-hmm. The second book is a behavioral finance book, and I'm going to cheat here and give you two. The definitive work in the space is Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, and that's a wonderful book, and I recommend everybody read it, at least the first half. I know it's a big book. You make your way through the first three quarters, you will have gotten most of it. But the book that really changed my life was a Cornell professor, Thomas Gilovich. He wrote a book in the early 90s called How We Know What Isn't So, The Fallibility of Human Reason in Everyday Life. That could be the first mainstream book about behavioral economics ever published. And that book, which I don't even know how I found, this is long before Amazon. This is strolling in a Barnes & Noble, pulling it off the shelf. That book sent me down the rabbit hole of behavioral finance in the early to mid 90s, and that completely changed the entire trajectory of my career. That when I was trying to figure out why the guy on my left was making money and the guy on my right was losing money, and that's the book that sent me down that, and that's absolutely changed the whole way I approach everything. And then finally, How We Know It Isn't So by Gilovich, and then finally, anything Michael Lewis writes is a must read, but Moneyball, The Art of Winning an Unfair Game is absolutely a favorite and so influential in terms of it's ostensibly about baseball, but really it's about what are the...
Is the movie Moneyball also based on the...
Yeah, that's the
movie. I love the movie. I have the book, so...
I like the movie. The book is spectacular. You'll love it. But it's really a giant metaphor for there are ways for the underdog to beat the prevailing winners by the intelligent use of understanding how things happen by the application of data. It's absolutely amazing.
So the second question is, what are the three movies that you have enjoyed the most?
So the first one is easy. The first one is going to be Blade Runner. I mentioned Philip K. Dick. It's based on a book, on a short story he wrote called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? The original Blade Runner, probably the most influential science fiction movie of the past 40 years. Just everything we've seen since then is based on that. The sequel is pretty good. It just came out last year, but the first one is amazing. I'm going to go back to for the second movie, I'm going to go back to one of my favorite screwball comedies of the early era. The Lady Eve is one of the funniest movies ever made. I'm always shocked when people are not familiar with that from 1941. It's Henry Fonda and Barbara Stanwyck, and it's just a spectacularly hilarious movie from a different era. And then of the more recent comedies that I'm infatuated with, I'm going to give you a tie between Groundhog Day, which is just unbelievably funny.
Very popular movie, yeah.
And then Harry Met Sally. My wife and I used to watch that every New Year's Eve. It was just one of those sort of movies. But Blade Runner, Lady Eve, and Groundhog Day, that's a hell of a set right there.
So the third question is, what is the most useful product or service that you have bought in recent memory?
How recent? So I've been using WordPress for the blog since 2008, and it's just an amazing piece of software. the fact that anybody with an internet connection could go to the world, here's my column, my article, my this, my that. WordPress could be the most influential piece of software of the past 20 years. Recently, I have to say that Venmo is so unbelievably convenient. And it's one of those things that after you start using it, it's like, how did we not have this forever? So my office, most offices in the U.S. will do a football pool, right? We have the Super Bowl coming up. There'll be, you know, this pool and all these silly things. And I remember it wasn't that long ago that any office that did a pool, somebody would get tagged to walk around with an envelope and say, hey, you got to go collect $20 from each person and put in this envelope. It was a giant pain in the ass. Now everybody just Venmos. Here's the cash. It's automatic. It's really one of those things that has changed how you move cash around. It's astonishing. And finally, Uber is such a game changer. I would recommend the book Super Pumped about the history of Uber. It's fascinating. But we forget, it's one of those products that you forget. You used to, I was in Paris for my anniversary. You land, you hit the Uber button, the car is there. There's no language issue. There's no anything. It's astonishing how amazing Uber is. And we overlook what a spectacular product it is. I wouldn't recommend the stock. I think it's wildly overvalued. But that said, the product itself is just a game changer. So those are my three. WordPress, Venmo, and Uber really have changed the world, and that's astonishing.
So the fourth question in out of the five is, what are the most important realizations you've had in the last couple of years? And we had some guests who shared something deeply personal about their career, relationships, time. So speak to anything you feel comfortable sharing with us today.
So personally or professionally?
Both. Feel free to speak to anything, yeah.
There's a lot here. There's a lot to unpack here. Well, I'll give you a recent one, which is a little heavy, but so I have a buddy who had a aortic bovine heart valve replacement put in about 20 years ago. And this is the medical technology that if you have a bad heart valve that used to kill you back in the day, and now this, extends your life for, normal, healthy lifespan. He not too long ago got pneumonia and attacked the heart valve, and he very quickly succumbed and passed away. And, when you hit your 50s, you start to notice friends and family dying more regularly. And that realization was life is short. Enjoy the ride while you're here. The finance industry is often about planning for the future, thinking about retirement, thinking about sending your kids to college or whatever it is. But it's really easy to lose sight that, what's 85 years? It's nothing. It goes by like that. If you don't stop and appreciate what you have, and sometimes saving for the future isn't the right thing to do. Sometimes you got to stop and smell the roses. And, the result of him, he was a car buddy. We used to go out and look at cars all the time. He was a professional appraiser of antique cars. He had worked with Ralph Lauren, who had an amazing car collection. And when he passed away, I stopped and thought about all the different cars that we had looked at, and I never bought any of them. It was more about looking at cars than buying one. And I basically said, life is short, what am I waiting for? And I went out and bought some monstrosity of a automobile, because one day we're all dead and nobody looks back from their deathbed and regrets the things they did. They look back from their deathbed and regret the things they didn't do. And I didn't want to have those regrets. And so life is short. You got to enjoy life. That's probably the most important realization I've had in the past 2 years.
The last question for today is, What would you tell your 20-year-old self?
Again, professionally or personally or both?
Both, please.
So professionally is easy. I wish I understood that in the world of finance, you are your assets under management. I didn't get that 25 years ago. In fact, I didn't even become serious about that until 7 or 8 years ago. And so I feel like I'm 20 years behind. I should, you know, we have over $1 billion. I feel like we should have $10 billion by now. I look at other firms that have been around for 25 years with $5, $10, $20 billion. That should be us. So I feel like I'm very late to the party. And that's very motivating. I wish I was less naive about compounding 3 decades ago, not just your personal portfolio, but your business compounds. You achieve a certain degree of success and that builds on itself. So that's one thing I would have told myself 25 or 30 years ago. Personally, philosophically, you can't know this when you're in your 20s or 30s, but hey, you know, it's all going to work out. Enjoy the ride. Try not to stress out too much. It'll work out. I don't mean that you should be lazy. I don't mean you should actually not think about any of this. But for me, the not knowing how my career was going to unfold, was definitely a source of frustration and stress. And if I could go back to my 25-year-old self or my 20-year-old self, I would say work hard and enjoy the ride, because, you know, sometimes you have to look around and realize what's going on. It's not just the destination. It's the journey also.
Barry, thank you so much for your time, and thank you so much for the episode.
Oh, my pleasure, Hardy. These are really interesting. You know, in my podcast, I have 10 questions I ask all my guests, and yours are very similar to mine. So these were easy to answer.
Have a good day.
Thank you for listening. If you like this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. Also, make sure to share the podcast and tell your friends about it. Thank you so much for supporting the show. I'll see you in the next episode. Over and out.